Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm, and on today's show, we will be providing a comprehensive deep dive look at the 2024 SEC enforcement numbers published at the end of last year, including what was behind some of the eye-popping numbers themselves, distinct areas of focus, and what firms can expect under a Paul Atkins-led Securities and Exchange Commission. To help guide us through this important topic and share some fantastic insights for our listeners, we welcome in an incredible panel of experts, Brian Rubin from Evershed Sutherland and Jim Lundy from Foley & Lardner. The interview with Brian and Jim was exceptional and went even longer than I had anticipated. And given the importance of the subject matter and the fantastic content that was produced, we went ahead and structured this show as another installment of our Lessons from the Frontline series. We've talked about these shows before, but for some of our new listeners, the Lessons from the Frontline series focus on real-life, tough-to-tackle subjects that other industry professionals and regulators and former regulators have faced on the front lines of our industry. And if you're anything like me, you probably saw the SEC enforcement numbers drop at the end of November and had quite a few questions on your mind. So to help answer these important questions and many more, I know the best thing for me to do at this point is get up and out of the way. And so with that, let's dive into the interview with Brian and Jim. As we move into the interview section of today's show, I am incredibly pleased to be joined by a couple of stalwarts to talk about one of the most important topics that we got to get a little glimpse into at the end of 2024, and certainly one that's always on the top of folks' minds in the legal and compliance space, and that is, of course, of SEC enforcement. Joining me today, I have Mr. Brian Rubin and Mr. Jim Lundy. And Brian, of course, is a returning guest on the show, someone we've had before, and always love to hear his thoughts and insights along with his incredible wit. And joining him today for the first time, I'm very excited to welcome Mr. Jim Lundy, who hasn't been on the show before, but for many of those folks that also are NSCP members, you may know Jim from several other contexts in which he provides very valuable insight in a variety of different capacities. I am going to first kick it over to Brian and Jim, do a quick intro of themselves, and then we'll dive into the topic of the 2024 SEC enforcement results. Mr. Rubin, why don't we start with you?
Thanks, Patrick. Glad to be back. And I have a lot of pressure given the hype that you just had. I am co-head of the Securities Enforcement Group at Eversheds. I've been here over 20 years. Before that, I was Deputy Chief Counsel of Enforcement at NASD. And before that, I was with the SEC in the Enforcement Division. I've been very active with NSCP for a number of years. I used to be on the board. I'm currently on the Publications Committee, and I am also currently co-head of the BD Forum. So we regularly discuss enforcement and regulatory issues there.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Lundy?
Sure. Thanks, Patrick. Thanks, Brian. Great to be here today with you and with Brian. Jim Lundy, I'm a partner at Foley & Lardner in their Securities Enforcement and Litigation Group. Prior to that in my career, I spent actually, to this point, still the vast majority of my career on the staff at the SEC in senior roles in the Division of Enforcement and then in the Division of Examinations. Did a brief stint in-house at a brokerage affiliate of a large global bank, so I had the chance to work closely with compliance in that regard. Was at another firm for several years, and very soon here I'll be celebrating my third anniversary at Foley & Lardner. I've really enjoyed working with and partnering with BP and folks like yourselves. Have not been doing it as long or as well as Brian, but my goal is someday to get there, and have been working with Rick Marshall, co-hosting the monthly forum for investment advisors for the past 2 years or so, and I really enjoyed that experience.
Yeah, that's great. I'll be honest, you're in good company when you haven't been doing it as well or as for as long when it comes to stuff in the NSCP as Mr. Rubin. But
and I think more folks show up to watch yours than mine.
So. I don't know about that. I should say as well, not as long as well.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Focus on quality.
Suffice to say, we have an incredible panel that I'm so excited to get into some of the issues around SEC enforcement.
And at the end of 2024, we had the enforcement results from the SEC that came out. And I certainly think there were a lot of things that were probably expected in those enforcement results. And there were probably a few things that we're going to talk about that may have been a little surprising or that may lead to a few more additional questions.
I think one of the things that I would love to do, and since we did heap so much praise on him early on, Jim, I feel like it's our duty now to hold Brian's feet to the fire here early. So maybe, Brian, just to start with you, let's even go super high level, right? These are the fiscal year 2024 SEC enforcement results. When did they come out, and what are some of the numbers and trends and other things that really stood out to you when you take a look at this?
Sure. And I was trying to analogize it, and because we're almost at the Super Bowl time, looking at the past Patriots experience with Tom Brady, then he's no longer there. Is there anything that we can predict from what happened in the past? And the answer is probably not. But the SEC, as we all know, under Chair Gensler, brought a lot of cases, a lot of big cases, and touted them significantly. So on November 22nd, the SEC announced its enforcement results for fiscal year 2024. And I'll go over some of the stats, some of the details, and then talk about what they mean and some of the implications a little bit. They filed 583 enforcement actions during fiscal year 2024. And they obtained orders for $8.2 billion in fines and other financial sanctions, which was the highest amount in SEC history. Of that total, $2.1 billion was in civil penalties, $6.1 billion was disgorgement and prejudgment interest. The $8.2 billion represents a 67% increase from $4.9 billion in fiscal year 2023, so huge increase. The SEC, on the other hand, distributed $345 million to harmed investors, and that was actually a 63% decrease from the year before. In terms of regulated entities, the commission brought 98 actions against broker-dealers, which was a 30% decrease from the year before. And the way enforcement deals with its numbers, they lump together investment companies and investment advisors for some strange reason. And combined, they brought 135 actions, which was a 3% decrease from the 139 they brought the year before. So a couple of things regarding these statistics. First, some people have questioned whether the SEC was misleading with regard to the sanctions, because 56% of the $8.2 billion, so the majority of the sanctions, was in connection with one case where it's been reported that the SEC will collect little, if anything, of that amount. It's a crypto company. They went bankrupt, so there's probably nothing there. The second thing to note is, if you're paying attention to all the number of cases actually declined. It was a 26% decrease from the year before, and that was actually the lowest figure in the last 10 years. So some huge, big impact cases, a lot of off-channel, which Jim's going to talk about in a while. So that's what sort of pumped up the numbers in terms of the actual number of enforcement cases. That was down. And then the other thing to note is, before everybody left and shut the doors behind them, they came out with another announcement looking at the last quarter. So on January 17th, right before everybody left, they announced quarterly results. And that was actually the first time that enforcement has announced quarterly results. And they were basically saying, hey, we were still here doing a great job. And they announced 200 enforcement actions in the first quarter. And that, they said, was the most number of actions in a quarter since at least 2000. The bottom line is, the SEC was very busy under Chair Gensler, and past performance is not necessarily indicative of future results, as we will talk about.
You hit the nail on the head there perfectly. Good use of that very frequent marketing disclosure that we see. And I certainly find it a little bit ironic that some of the very claims that are often levied against folks levied against firms for inflating or exaggerating their own numbers and other related stuff. Ultimately, I think there's some substantive issues with some of the numbers that they've talked about here, but.
Right. We call it touting, right?
Yeah. Thank you for that high level summary, Brian. That's super helpful. Jim, any specific reaction to some of Brian's thoughts or comments there, or any other items in the enforcement results that really stood out to you?
Yeah. So I'll talk about the off-channel settlements. Speaking of past data not being indicative of future results. In fiscal year 24, the commission brought cases against more than 70 firms, resulting in $600 million more in additional penalties. For those of us who've been living through this for the past several years, no surprise that prior to January 2025, that leads to some pretty big numbers. And in the release, enforcement touted that since December of 2021, the initiatives in this space have resulted in charges against more than 100 firms and civil penalties in excess of $2 billion. As Brian mentioned, enforcement continued to be busy after the election through its first fiscal quarter for this fiscal year, and recently announced on January 13th, 12 more actions brought against 9 investment advisors and 3 broker dealers for off-platform books and records record-keeping violations, and an additional $63.1 million in total penalties brought against those 12 firms. As we'll be talking about a little bit later on in our time together here, transitioning from the past fiscal year to what things may look like under Chair nominee Atkins, it will remain to be seen if there will be much, if any, activity in this space from an enforcement perspective. There likely will continue to be from an examination perspective, but the January 13th actions and the additional $63.1 million, I'm sure for many of us, are what we hope to be the last significant wave of these types of off-platform messaging cases. But a lot of activity in this space under Chair Gensler, to the tune of well over $2 billion plus the 63.1 obtained just in the most recent actions a little over 2 weeks ago.
Hmm. Yeah. Again, even just hearing, and while I recognize that some of those numbers may have been touted a little bit higher than normal, we certainly have seen over the last several years under Chair Gensler a very active enforcement division that was tended to take a pretty aggressive posture when it came to holding firms accountable in areas like you just mentioned, Jim, in the off-channel business communication space and elsewhere. I'm a little interested. A lot of times this is a topic that will frequently come up in conversations when we're talking about regulatory enforcement matters and whether or not some firms ultimately decide to self-report, or sometimes firms might look at gaining some kind of credibility with the staff or commission for cooperating in certain contexts. Brian, maybe I'll pitch it back over to you. Did you see any of that here with regard to any of the summaries provided by the staff as it related to the 2024 enforcement results?
Yeah, and actually specifically with regard to the off-channel cases, for a number of the press releases, when they brought enforcement cases in this area, they specifically highlighted that certain of the firms did self-report, and therefore there's a reduced penalty for that firm. So, for example, the most recent round of cases that Jim talked about, one of the 12 firms self-reported, and according to the SEC, they face significantly lower penalties. And in that case, the firm was paid $600,000 in penalties. The other firms, the penalties range from $12 million to $4 million. But the caveat on that is that for the most part, the sanctions in those cases are related to the size of the firm, and that was a smaller firm. So, and there have also been a number of other actions I've noticed for the past couple of years where the orders have paid lip service to the fact that the firm cooperated. Sometimes there's an additional couple of sentences that have been drawn out in the orders highlighting that fact without a lot of detail. So I think that's interesting. And I think that also supports the message that the staff and the commission really do want firms to think strong and hard about self-reporting and ultimately cooperating.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. What about some of the other big areas that we've heard about over the past several years? And certainly, we've seen even guidance around from the Division of Exams, by way of example, through some of their risk alerts that have come out over the past couple of years around the marketing rule. And oftentimes, those tend to be good harbingers of stuff that they're also looking at or other cases that may be interesting to the SEC from the enforcement side. Did we see anything, or were you able to glean any specific information around the marketing front that stood out to you? Maybe Jim, I'll throw it back to you for that one.
Yeah, sure. As you mentioned, we've seen really good information and guidance come out in the risk alerts. Yeah, the marketing rule is an area where we saw what I think we hope to see again under an Atkins commission, which was a really important rule came out that reflected coordination with the industry. Educational information came out in the context of FAQs. And then we saw risk alerts from examiners. And then intermittently, obviously, certain firms may have been delayed or had breakdowns or may have just been running afoul of the new rule. But what we saw was referrals coming out of that leading to enforcement actions, which is really the way the process should work. And again, we're hopeful to return to that. But as a result of that output through those referrals, we continue to see enforcement activity in this space in the past fiscal year. More than a dozen investment advisors were charged for violations of the marketing rule. And those violations involve things such as advertising hypothetical performance to the general public when you don't have the appropriate policies and procedures and implementation of those policies and procedures tailored to the firm and reasonably designed to ensure that those hypo performance numbers are in fact relevant to the likely financial situation and objectives of the advertisement's intended audience. Also, cases involving untrue or unsubstantiated statements of material fact and or in relation to testimonials, endorsements, and third-party ratings, and a failure to have appropriate disclosures regarding those testimonials, endorsements, and third-party ratings. That was one of the areas that the industry embraced, was the ability to use testimonials and endorsements and third-party ratings in marketing materials. But there was a lot that needed to be put in place regarding policies and procedures and processes so that those were done in a manner to be in compliance with the marketing rule. And there has been some breakdowns that we've seen in the industry in that regard, and that's been a focus area of enforcement activity in this particular area. And then the last one is just where we've seen, unfortunately, some misleading performance numbers that were either done to inflate data or perhaps were not fair and balanced. And that's where you've seen a little more aggressive enforcement activity. So the marketing rule activity, I think, will continue as a priority for the examination program going forward. And I think we can reasonably expect to see continuing referrals and, when appropriate, enforcement looking to take action.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good color, Jim. And I certainly think, to echo some of those points, we're more than several years, or we're more than 2 years past the compliance date with the SEC marketing rules. So the idea that putting forward a good faith effort but getting it completely wrong probably isn't really going to fly nearly as well now that folks have had lots of time to come into compliance. And to your point too about the risk alerts, right, they've gotten a lot of of really good guidance in those risk alerts from the Division of Exams, and even looking through some of the prior enforcement actions that you talked about, right? I think you said that there's been about a dozen different marketing rule related charges that have come out, including stuff around hypothetical performance and testimonials and endorsements and misleading performance. And so firms can certainly would certainly do well to adhere or learn from the mistakes that some of those other advisors had made and try to make sure that they've got the right internal controls and policies and procedures there to come into compliance.
Well, the rollout was similar to with Reg BI in that there's a rule, there's been some guidance, there were exams, not with enforcement actions unless firms didn't do anything at all. And then over time, there's been a rollout of enforcement actions with additional guidance. And the additional thing there was the SEC and FINRA both have jurisdiction. So initially, we saw SEC cases, and over time, we've been seeing more FINRA cases.
Yeah, that's great. And a good point, Brian. I think that overall, with these different enforcement actions, firms are certainly aware of, at least over the past couple of years, where the SEC has been spending a lot of its time, energy, and focus. But I don't know if either of you heard, in the fourth quarter of last year, there was an election. It resulted in a new administration taking over. And now, obviously, we've got some new appointments and other things that are going to be made, even for areas and agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission. I think another thing that would be really, I think, beneficial for a lot of our listeners today is to have you both do a little bit of looking in your crystal ball, a little soothsaying here.
Even though we have a podcast, I have an SEC crystal ball, in fact.
There you go.
It's broken a little bit, but we'll see what we can do.
We'll still give it the old college try, as they like to say. So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned Atkins before. Obviously, there's still some logistics that needs to occur for everything to, I think, become officially official. I would love to hear from both of you about kind of everything that's going on there. But maybe let's start with some more broad stroke type things that you expect to change under an SEC led by Commissioner Atkins. Soon to be, I think everybody thinks Commissioner Atkins, and maybe what possible kind of process changes or other types of administrative type changes you might see within the agency. Brian, since you graciously added that crystal ball to the conversation, maybe I'll start by picking on you.
Sure. And we have a list of a few things that may happen. So one of them is that there's probably going to be a push to reduce the time that it takes to investigate cases. Everybody on the defense side and on enforcement side thinks it takes too long, and there's a variety of reasons that it does take a while. One idea is a simple idea to just simply shorten the time period that investigations have. And although President Trump said he did not read Project 2025, which was a huge sort of white paper on things the new administration could do, one of the recommendations it contained called for statutorily limiting the time for investigations to 2 years. Jim and I have both been in the staff. I'm not sure how realistic either of us thinks that is, but I do think there will be a push and there will be metrics followed by the staff in order to reduce the time it takes to investigate. I think there's going to be more focused subpoenas and document requests, fewer on the record testimony, things like that, in an attempt to address this issue. And I also think from the defense side, if we get pushed by the folks in enforcement, we have to similarly see that they're not sitting on evidence for 6 months or a year before they get back to us, because I think the defense side and firms need to see that the push is not just on our side, but there's also a push on the other side. And I do think that there is a lot of room for the folks at enforcement to move cases faster. So I think that is going to be one of the concrete things we will see.
Jim, any reaction to those thoughts from Brian, or anything when you think about Paul Atkins potentially coming in and taking a leadership position at the staff? Is there anything else that comes to your mind that you might see is likely to change?
Yeah, I think one change that we're going to see is renewed engagement with the SEC Wells process. So historically, that was treated as, in a way, the end of the investigative activity. And while there would be advocacy throughout the investigative process, it was really viewed as some of, in some way, the start, the more formal start of that. Under Chair Gensler's enforcement division, there was really a lot less engagement in the Wells process. And quite frankly, it was discouraged or at times outright refused. And in order to be able to advocate in some appropriate way on behalf of our clients, we began to issue white papers or much more substantive written submissions vis-a-vis a PowerPoint or detailed cover submissions with our written responses for document productions, things that may still occur strategically. But I think with what we're seeing and what we're hearing regarding new enforcement leadership under Atkins being much more willing to engage in discourse through the Wells process, that we'll see a decline in that. And I think that does relate to what Brian talked about, because with that engagement moving to the traditional Wells noticed, Wells submission process, and I think Brian's going to talk about Wells discovery in a little bit, the investigation phase itself should be able to be done more efficiently. And we're already seeing that, even though Atkins has not been sworn in. It was just earlier this week at the Securities Enforcement Forum in New York that a senior enforcement official stated publicly that she, in fact, expected this practice to start with the acting enforcement director, and that he'll be beginning to take more Wells meetings than his predecessor did. But the Wells process, of course, has its own nuances to it, starting with the Wells discovery process. And I think Brian had some thoughts on that, Patrick.
Yeah. So following up on that, one of the issues historically has been that if a firm or an individual gets Wells, during the Wells call, the staff says, we've preliminarily determined that you have violated X, Y, and Z. And frequently, they don't offer a lot of evidence to support it. So unless you've been involved as defense counsel with the entire case and know all of the discovery that the SEC has and understands the implications of all of the discovery, you can put in a submission if you know everything. If you don't know everything, there's a problem with that. And sometimes we end up pushing back to the staff and saying, what's the evidence for that? We didn't represent that individual. I don't know what he said. How can I address it? So there's been talk, and actually Paul Atkins gave a speech in 2008 on this issue advocating for an open jacket policy. And open jacket discovery is a term that's used more with criminal proceedings where the prosecutors turn over, in effect, the entire investigative file. The SEC doesn't do that, but I think we will see inroads so that the staff will be in a position to turn over more of its evidence and to highlight evidence if the firm or individual or counsel representing them doesn't have that evidence, because it's really viewed as a due process issue. It's hard to defend yourself if you don't know what the evidence is. And conversely, from enforcement's point of view, they want to get it right. And in order to get it right, the other side has to know what the evidence is and what the staff views as important evidence versus unimportant evidence. So I think all of this will help the process tremendously. And as we've talked about, although it's an additional step, I think at the end of the day, it speeds things up in addition to providing the due process rights.
That would certainly see, one, thank you both for that kind of background and additional context there. as someone who's not as involved on the enforcement side, certainly given how you've described that process, it would definitely seem like there could be very strong mutual benefits, both from certainly from the registrant's side, but also from the commission's side as well, in order to help alleviate some of the inaccuracies or other types of things that may ultimately develop in the course of a proceeding like that. And then obviously from the firm side to be able to better understand what it is that they're being charged with and how to, they can potentially add context to the actions that they took in certain instances that were done not in any kind of way to exacerbate violative conduct, but rather to potentially mitigate or remediate issues that may have been occurring inside of the firm. Very good to know. One other thing I would be interested to know is, as we have continued to evolve, it's crazy to think about, we're just a couple months away from the 5-year anniversary of the COVID-19 virus and pandemic and the other stuff that occurred as a result of that. And during the course of that time, I know that there has been, from a logistical perspective, virtual hearings and other on the record types of meetings that have taken place. Was wondering if either of you had a good beat on whether or not that was a practice that was going to continue even under an Atkins leadership.
So before Jim answers the serious question that you just asked, I think, Patrick, you could take this podcast on the road instead of virtually. We could just go to everybody's offices individually and do the show.
I'm here for it, Brian. Let's do it. Okay. I'm ready.
Yeah, listen, as you mentioned, Patrick, and I think as Brian just joked about it, we all have embraced, and there's tons of positive aspects of the virtual work environment that we've grown so comfortable with. It's for how horrifying everything was with the pandemic and everything that we all had to live through. From a business practice and legal practice perspective, being able to utilize virtual platforms such as our podcast, such as Teams meetings, is a benefit. But it's a benefit that I think in the context of SEC testimony sessions has faded for all. My personal view, I'm sure Brian would agree, but testimony sessions are one of the most important aspects of the investigative process for all involved, for the staff, for defense counsel, and while it can be uncomfortable, most importantly, the witness. When I went into private practice in 2016, presented a CEO of a firm, they wanted him for 3 days. We ended up doing 2.5. It was the other end of the extreme. It was too much. But really, that testimony and those transcripts became incredibly important in the Wells process that Brian was just talking about, and allowed us to get a really positive result for the client. And I don't know if we would be afforded that level of interaction in an in-person testimony session today, because it's really the pendulum, I think, swung too far in the other direction. And what you started to see is brief virtual sessions, with all due respect to the staff, becoming a little too cavalier, a little sloppy. Exhibits are cumbersome to use. Less exhibits were being used. And some of it is not surprising. It's just, it's human nature. There is something more professional, more intense about being in a setting in person, in a conference room at the SEC or at a law firm, and having that in-person interaction. And for the vast majority of witnesses that folks like Brian and I represent, when they're going to be good witnesses, we want that. And we think the staff wants that too. We've been hearing things that the new administration, and including perhaps the new leadership at the SEC, wants federal government employees to be returning to in-office work much closer to full-time or close to it. I don't know what all the issues are that are going to be involved in that from labor and employment perspectives, but from the OTR perspective and the SEC investigative process, I think that we're going to see changes in that regard. I think incoming Chair Atkins is going to want that to happen. And that is simply an investigative process thing that I think can be implemented relatively quickly and is not going to require the same level of hurdles that will need to be worked through for folks to return, quote, quote unquote, in office to work full time or close to it.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. And looking someone in the eye, that phrase, I think, is very important because you do get a better sense of someone when you're sitting face to face in person rather than through a screen. And from our defense viewpoint, it helps a lot to be able to calm your witness down, put your hand on the person's shoulder, occasionally whisper to the person, go outside, saying calm down, or during prep, you talked about this, you should probably emphasize it more. So the dynamics are a lot different in person than they are over a video.
That's really good feedback. And I certainly think that anecdotally, in a lot of other very different contexts, I think the same principles that you both just articulated of some of the benefits of having that in-person contact. And then in your particular case, as their counsel with your client who's in those shoes and undergoing the questioning and the interview, makes a lot of sense to me. What about if I go back out a little bit, or I think more broadly, again, under what a regime at the Securities and Exchange Commission could mean for Paul Atkins, when you think about some of the other things that might be in his focus here as he potentially takes the helm, is there anything else that kind of stands out to you? And what would some of those things look like?
There are so many things. So one of them is a reduction in penalties. As we talked about at the opening, last year was a record-setting year in terms of penalties for the SEC. And there was a push under Chair Gensler and the prior heads of enforcement for higher penalties to deter. And frankly, there were questions about the appropriateness of that level of sanctions, given sometimes the lack of investor harm or the lack of pecuniary gain. So we expect, I think all of us expect, that under the new administration, the level of penalties will be significantly lower. And I found one article, I didn't check this, so I don't know if it's right. The article said that there were over 200 times when Commissioners Peirce and Ueda, who are both still serving, voted to approve enforcement recommendations except as to the penalties imposed because they thought that they were too high. When Paul Atkins was commissioner previously, he had given a number of speeches on penalties. And one of the things that he focused on was the impact of penalties on companies and in particular issuers, arguing that really when you're applying a penalty to a company, it's really being borne by the shareholders. And that might not be appropriate. And I think a lot of the clients that we represent as registrants aren't public companies, but certainly some of them are. But other factors that are relevant that have been in some of the speeches, either by Atkins or some of the other commissioners, deal with predictability, that really penalties should be predictable as opposed to, oh, it feels like the right number. Mm-hmm. Another issue is the effect on individuals, and Atkins did talk about this issue of moral hazard, in that executives at companies might agree to a larger corporate penalty in order to avoid or lessen sanctions on individuals. And there's a question as to whether that makes sense. And then another issue that's been highlighted is the effect on the SEC staff. If they're just going for large penalties, is that how staff resources and attention should be? Or should they be focusing on customer harm, doing what's right, that sort of thing? I think the bottom line is we will see lower penalties overall and lower total penalties.
It makes a lot of sense. Jim, I'd be interested in any of your feedback on that, or if there's anything else that, you think stands out when thinking about an Atkins regime. But to your point specifically, Brian, just quickly, I've even heard in other remarks, Commissioner Peirce makes similar statements around the harm that ultimately gets borne by the investors of those companies and other folks that are involved in, and when it comes to enforcement and specifically penalties and sanctions like that, you can ultimately do some things that are counterproductive or whatever. When your goal is to safeguard investors, then at times, sometimes we need to think about what the long-term effect of what some of those penalties could realize or manifest.
Yeah, and Commissioners Peirce and Ueda both worked for Paul Atkins when he was a commissioner, so they are all of like mind. So I think there's going to be a very, very strong, at least three commissioner majority once he does become chairman.
Makes sense. Jim, thoughts on some of Brian's comments or anything else about an Atkins regime that kind of stands out to you?
Sure. I have one thought on individuals just to amplify a couple of things that Brian said, and then maybe I'll turn to crypto a little bit because that's going to be a priority as well in terms of changing, I think, how the commission has been viewing that area of the industry. But just to amplify what Brian said, based on all of his statements, speeches while he was a commissioner, incoming Chair Atkins touted repeatedly that he viewed individual actors as the drivers behind the corporation or this entity as the decision makers, and that they need to be the focus. I think, interestingly enough, when you start to tie all this together and you also take into account what he has stated regarding less of a focus on negligence-based violations, we could go back to what we used to see in terms of how the process worked when he was a commissioner, which is, for example, say we have a rep who's being investigated for cherry picking. He may have much more heightened individual exposure than he did under Chair Gensler. But for the firm, we could see opportunities where they could engage in a meaningful Wells process, be fully cooperative and engage in remedial efforts throughout the investigation, where they could perhaps go in and persuade the staff to not recommend failure to supervise charges and 206-47 violation charges against the firm. And I think what we've seen in the past few years is those are almost automatic check-the-box throw-ins. And we could see an opportunity with some Wells advocacy, like Brian talked about previously, coupled with this focus on individuals, where that type of engagement could result for the firms in successful outcomes. Unfortunate for the individuals, but for the firms, we could see some of this engagement and advocacy lead to more positive outcomes during the Wells process after investigations are complete.
Yeah, no, that's great. You did mention one of our buzzwords of the day a moment ago, which I feel like could be used on any day of the week that ends in Y, but that's, of course, crypto. So I am super interested in getting your thoughts on what I've seen a few articles, maybe a couple of headlines, but would be interested in certainly your thoughts on the matter.
Sure. So revealing my age, when people used to use records, this is probably sounding like a broken record because it's another Atkins priority. And Brian's already touched on a couple of them, but digital assets will be a priority for him. It's an area of the industry that he's been actively engaged in. He serves as co-chair of the Token Alliance. It's an organization that serves as the cryptocurrency advocacy arm for the Chamber of Digital Commerce. And post-inauguration day, we've already seen this, right? The very next day, Acting Chair Ueda announced a new crypto initiative called Crypto 2.0 and named Commissioner Peirce the head of this task force. The release stated, and I'm just quoting, open quote, "The task force's focus will be to help the commission draw clear regulatory lines, provide realistic paths to registration, craft sensible disclosure frameworks, and deploy enforcement resources judiciously," close quote. Probably emphasis on the last one for those in that industry who have lived through regulation by enforcement. When it comes to regulation by enforcement in the digital asset industry, it's not going to come to an end. It's being brought to a screeching halt. I think what we can expect is some coordination with the CFTC regarding regulatory oversight, and that from a rulemaking area of the commission under Chair Atkins. We're going to see this as a priority area. We've already seen this start to unfold with Acting Chair Ueda and Commissioner Peirce with this Crypto 2.0, who, as Brian said, served on Commissioner Atkins' staff when he was making some of the statements that are publicly available or making some of the dissents that we'll talk about in a little bit regarding his views.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thoughts, Brian, on any of those items or thoughts from Jim? And as far as some of the other more substantive type changes that it sounds like you might have with an Atkins regime being focused on crypto, are there any other kind of substantive topic areas that you expect maybe a little bit more of a change of direction?
Yeah, so we talked about off-channel and how big and important it was. And I think, as Jim alluded to, the general thinking is that's going to stop. In mid-2024, Commissioners Peirce and Ueda dissented from one of the settlements where it appeared that the commission was having a strict liability standard, and they specifically said that we have to reconsider our current approach to off-channel communications issues. And in that case, it sounded like the firm was doing all the right things. They required personnel to have firm issue devices to conduct business and text. They trained, they monitored, they disciplined. And then the order said that the firm failed to implement sufficient monitoring to ensure that its record keeping and communications policies were always being followed. And as all of us know, policies, procedures have a reasonableness standard as opposed to an always standard. Given that, and given the new makeup of the commission, and given the eye-popping penalties and the concerns that have been expressed throughout the industry with regard to these off-channel communications, I think we won't see those kinds of cases. We will see cases if the staff is investigating a certain issue and they're going to charge in that issue and it turns out that there is a gap in emails or texts that are important, they'll certainly have those kinds of charges. But in terms of the standalone cases, and specifically the standalone cases with these crazy eye-popping penalties, those, I think, will be in the history books.
Yeah. What about another area that, at least during the Gensler regime, seemed to take on quite a bit of publicity? Shadow trading and other kind of insider trading type issues that came up. Do you expect Atkins' regime to continue that trend, or would you expect a shift there?
Yeah, so I see a shift there. Chair Atkins, when he was a commissioner, was a supporter of enforcement, but he's a supporter of enforcing the law, quote unquote, on the books. He's a supporter of protecting Main Street over the sophisticated investor class. And so when you start to think about things like novel legal theories, that just doesn't align with his historical views. And the Ponowit shadow insider trading case is probably one of the more extreme examples of the enforcement division pushing the envelope. In that case, as many may recall, there was an individual at a company who engaged in trading in violation of the company's insider trading policy when he used MNPI about a peer company in the industry that was comparable, but a different company, to purchase call options. Unfortunately for that individual, the SEC did win the case at trial. And after the verdict, many of us expected an emboldened enforcement staff to look to continue to push the boundaries in the area of insider trading, to pursue more cases like that, or perhaps to be creative in other ways. I think it's pretty reasonable to say, with what we know about Chair Atkins and about the fellow commissioners, Ueda and Peirce, who we've also been talking about, that the boundary pushing days in insider trading will be coming to an end.
Yeah, that would certainly make sense. And I've heard that from several folks who are touching the SEC enforcement area, certainly a lot more closely, and they would echo a lot of your sentiments there, Jim, including where you mentioned whenever harm has been done to the Main Street type of investor, that you see that, and that focus on where there's been an investor harm or customer harm in particular tends to be something that we would likely see with an Atkins administration of the SEC. Brian, would you tend to agree with that? And are there any other areas that you see a continuation of enforcement activity that's expected?
Yeah, I think that's right. And a lot of people have been comparing it to when Jay Clayton was the chair of the SEC. So you're right. Looking at retail investors, harm to investors, so things like offering frauds, Ponzi schemes, excessive fees, disclosures and conflicts, Reg BI, market manipulation, that sort of thing. And fewer sort of novel theories. Jim talked about shadow trading, charging CISOs, looking at disclosure controls. There have been some cases dealing with breaches that have been questionable. I think a lot of the focus will be on the Main Street investor, and then we have Reg BI. More recently, FINRA has been bringing more cases, but it wouldn't surprise me if the SEC ends up increasing the number of cases it brings because it may have additional staff. If it's not focusing on things like crypto or off-channel, they might be able to use some of that staff to look at Reg BI type issues.
Yeah, that makes sense. This has been an excellent conversation today. We've covered a ton of ground. I really thank you both very much for sharing so many of your insights in the enforcement space with us. I think to close up shop, I've got a couple questions, and they both certainly relate directly to Paul Atkins. Maybe Jim, maybe I'll pick on you for this question. I'm wondering, it's come up a couple times today that Paul Atkins previously served as a commissioner with the SEC. And so I'm wondering, is there anything during his past tenure in that role, either in the things that he specifically supported, or maybe even more importantly, in some of the things where maybe he offered a dissent, that helped tell us a little bit about him personally and what some of his priorities might look like?
Sure, thanks. Happy to answer that. I took a look actually at some of his dissents and some of the data. And the most readily available is for the last 28 months he served as commissioner from 2006 to 2008. And Atkins dissented 10 times. Now, that may not sound like a significant number with the more common frequency of dissents that we have seen in the intervening 15 or so years. But at that time, it was a significant number. It was more than twice as many as Democratic Commissioner Roel Campos in the same period of time. And comparatively, Democratic Commissioner Annette Nazareth and Republican Commissioner Kathleen Casey did not dissent one time during that entire 28-month window. And interestingly enough, where we see oftentimes joint dissents or joint statements, as we've described previously, for example, with Commissioners Ueda and Peirce, without Commissioner Casey dissenting, Commissioner Atkins essentially went it alone with his 10 dissents, which I think does indicate the type of person and professional that he is in terms of his willingness to go it alone and stand by his convictions. Much of what he dissented on focused on penalties and other areas that we've covered. He voted against the $7 million SEC settlement against IBM over accounting issues. Similarly, he opposed a 2008 settlement against Citigroup over alleged misstatements in its financial statements. And he did dissent also on smaller matters such as censures against unregistered accountants and other matters of that nature. I think as we look forward, because of the time that's passed and the issues at hand back then, we should look to Commissioners Pearson and Ueda's dissents. They've dissented or put out statements collectively or individually approximately 25 times. As Brian mentioned, they served on Atkins' staff. And when you look at the areas where they have filed their dissenting views and made them publicly known, it's much of what we've talked about: off-channel communications, the digital asset space, cybersecurity. They provided a detailed dissent on this commission's
attempt to use expansively the internal accounting control provisions of the federal securities laws. They dissented on this commission's expanding views on materiality. And as we've talked about, they've dissented in the area of civil penalties and dissented specifically on the area in the area of rising civil penalties. So I think we can expect the views that we've talked about today to actually be implemented soon, not just with Acting Commissioner Ueda, but in particular, and perhaps aggressively, when Chair Atkins is confirmed. And it's going to be in these areas when you look back historically in terms of where the dissenting statements were made by him, and more recently, and in more recent history, what Commissioners Ueda and Peirce have dissented on in terms of what we can expect to see in the future.
Yeah, that's really helpful context and some good data there. Brian, maybe I'll look to you to help close up shop today in using some of the information that Jim just shared, which I think is really valuable. What do you think is next for the SEC, and where do you see the leadership of the SEC? Where do you see it taking the commission in the future?
I think we'll see a lot more use of staff guidance and some rulemaking to encourage compliance rather than just bringing enforcement cases and enforcement by regulation by enforcement. In terms of the head of enforcement, who knows who it's going to be, but good lawyers are good lawyers. When Jim was at the SEC, he was a good prosecutor, and now he's a good defense attorney. I think whoever gets in that chair is going to do a good job. Nobody wants to be head of enforcement and just twiddle their thumbs all day long. So I think they're going to be bringing meaningful cases of the type that we talked about. And if you look at the world in terms of blue versus red, if you look at Republican versus Democrat, you can compare what happened at the SEC under Jay Clayton versus Mary Jo White. So under Clayton's tenure, the SEC brought about 10% fewer cases, so very similar number. But in terms of financial remedies, under Clayton's administration, they were actually higher than under Mary Jo White's administration. So I don't think it's a meaningful distinction to talk about Republican versus Democrat. I think the focus is going to be different, as we talked about, and I think they will continue to emphasize protecting the Main Street investors.
Thank you both so much. This has really been an incredible and enlightening conversation today. I'm so appreciative of all of the information you've shared around what I think are going to be some really nuanced transition time here at the commission. Real quick, would love to get your thoughts. We've obviously, my beloved Bengals unfortunately missed the playoffs this year. There is a big game coming up here soon, so we'll obviously be able to judge you later depending on what you say. But Super Bowl picks for who wins, Chiefs or the Eagles?
So I've just been listening to Michael Lewis's podcast on gambling, which I recommend to everybody. So I'm not betting on anything here. Chiefs by 6.
Okay. Mr. Lundy?
I think it's because Chicago has such poor professional sport teams that I always sympathize with the underdog. So I'm looking for the Eagles to win by 3.
There you go. As a Bengals fan, I am naturally predisposed to hate the Kansas City Chiefs as much as humanly possible. So I'm with you on this one, Mr. Lundy. Although I do find it funny that we're calling the Eagles an underdog, a team that has also recently.
Yeah, not in recent times, for sure. Yeah, they're a heck of a team. Jim, I think everybody who faces Patrick Mahomes, I think, can be rightfully considered an underdog.
Fair. Or Patrick Hayes.
Or Patrick Hayes.
Doth protest too much, I think, Mr. Rubin. But no, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And look forward to having you both back on the podcast here at some point down the road.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFEE and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Brian Rubin and Jim Lundy,
for coming on the show today to share their fantastic insights on the current state of SEC enforcement and what to expect in the future under a new administration. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on X using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.